The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
All right, ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Soul of Servano show here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a fantastic broadcast. Want to welcome in everybody on the panel. Of course, our host, John Servanos. John, how are you?
I think I'm good, Joe.
Well, you look good, my friend.
But you never really know, do you?
Yeah, no, you don't. You know, at least you wake up, you know, you're on this side of the grave, you know, the grave, you're fine. We got great guests, Ted Scher, Zarwin Barr. How are you, Ted?
Well, thank you.
All right. And we also have Greg Malum of Zarwin Barr. How are you?
Fantastic.
Gentlemen, if you would... John, you know, if remind our listeners, obviously, a little bit about yourself and the firm.
Well, as I've shared with the listeners before, we're a plaintiff's law firm exclusively representing people who get hurt.
How did these guys get in?
You know, I've met them both through cases, and was impressed, obviously, with both of them. I've known Ted since the two of us went to law school, and he's clearly the most successful of the graduating class. So I'm happy to have him here.
Very low bar. Very low threshold, trust
me. And I met Greg doing a case this past year and was, you know, right out of the box, I was very impressed with him. And I've even shared how impressed I was with him with Ted. He has a dry, semi-cynical approach to his practice and how he positions himself with the plaintiff, but very, very competent young guy.
Well, I'll tell you, I've often heard many stories of individuals working on the plaintiff side, they met their boss or their, you know, coworker when they were working on the defense side. You hear a lot of stories where relationships are built there. Ted, if you would, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and of course, the practice.
Sure. I've been practicing law since 1987. It's almost my 35th year. I have been with the same firm, Zarwin & Baum. I started clerking there as a third-year student, just writing for food, frankly, waiting for a job, and 35 years.
Could be a lot of pressure getting that coffee order.
Let me tell you, the story is that they offered me $10 an hour, and the other guy offered me $9. So Winston Churchill once said, "Madam, now that we know who you are, it's a matter of price." So when I joined the firm, we were 6 lawyers. The firm has grown to close to 70 lawyers. We're in Center City, Philadelphia, Marlton, Jersey City, and Wilmington, Delaware. Our firm is very diverse. We do a lot of corporate work. We represent a lot of banks and developers. Greg's practice and my practice surrounds defense work, which means the representation of companies, oftentimes hired by insurance companies to defend businesses in a wide variety of suits. And that is everything from automobile cases to bar cases, tractor trailer cases, and that's really our practice.
And Greg, if you would, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Greg Malin. I've been practicing since 2011, been with Zarwin Baum for about 5.5 years, primarily doing casualty defense work. Again, as Ted explained, self-insureds and their insurance companies hire us when they get suits, and they start shaking when they see guys like John Zervano's coming, and then we're here to kind of level the playing field.
Oh, yeah.
So,
well, it's interesting because I told you a little bit about my prior business. I was in the hospitality business, and ironically, I know some of my attorneys I've actually had on shows. I told you about Pat Lamb, and I've never had Drew Malik on, but certainly I learned a lot in the process, and it used to, they're certainly, you know, they were important to me, you know, because we were, we faced a lot, an onslaught. You talked about bars and well, that's, you know, we were a nightclub, and all kinds of stuff hit us. I mean, from everywhere possible. So you're there 15 years. By the 15th year, and when the economy got bad, it got worse. But, you know, we were tight. I mean, we were as tight as you could get, but it's like a tidal wave at times. Let's as and if you don't mind, John, because I know we're going to talk about, you know, some interesting situations where, you know, you guys all work together, and we're going to talk about the pandemic and how it impacted, you know, each one of your areas of the law and what you do on a daily basis. But as a defense attorney, your primary responsibilities are what, and what are the first things you do when that case comes across your desk?
Sure. So our practice is a little bit different than a lot of defense lawyers, primarily because we represent a lot of interstate transportation companies. So we oftentimes we get the cases from the moment they happen. We may get it. We run a 365-day, 24/7 emergency response program. So when you have a bus accident or a large trucking accident, our clients don't want to necessarily rely completely on local law enforcement. They may not have the resources. So we're brought in almost as a private national transportation safety board. We're brought in to collect evidence, analyze the facts, give them our impressions about liability very, very early on, and most importantly, to collect and preserve evidence. Our clients are sometimes we don't get notice of suit until our clients get notice of suit, which is a complaint. And we're brought in to protect them because both sides, John's clients and my clients, we all are entitled to our equal day in court. Impartial, based on the evidence, and we hope that juries, and they do, call balls and strikes, and judges call balls and strikes, and we reach the result that's fair and amicable.
It's interesting that you mentioned you don't get the case, you know, I guess until it's filed.
Sometimes.
Okay. Yeah. I used to drive me nuts. And one time I actually ran out to the car from my house to get the guy that just served me. And I'd say, this is like 2 years later. How in the world and why would I get served on the statute? Why does that happen?
Sometimes the you know, you have plaintiffs that delay in seeking counsel. They don't know they have a lawsuit. It takes some time. They run up medical bills. They are out of work. They speak to a friend. Friend says, you know, you should speak to a lawyer. Sometimes lawyers just delay filing suit as they're gathering information and doing their due diligence to ensure that when they file suit that they are ready to go. So there's a myriad of reasons. Certainly we look with a raised eyebrow when we get that case on the eve of the statute of limitations.
Yeah.
But it can happen, and it happens to good lawyers and sometimes not so good lawyers. So it varies. There's no real answer as to when a lawsuit's filed. Today, we're seeing cases filed very, very quickly, even more so than 10 years ago. It's not unusual for us to see a case filed within a month or 2 months because of a myriad of reasons.
In the hospitality business, 2 years is a lifetime. You know, I remember when I would get served, and I'd be like, you know, we have about, you know, 20% of the employees left from 2 years ago. It used to, and I called the guy when I ran out to the car, and he didn't have an explanation. John, you know, you're a plaintiff's attorney. What is the purpose for that?
Well, I'm going to respond to something that Ted said. He said sometimes, you know, we need to get out there quickly, preserve the evidence, which is actually an interesting point. I'd like to hear that they preserve the evidence, but and I'm not suggesting they don't. I'm just, it's interesting they can get out there at day one, which is an advantage that they have that we don't have as the plaintiffs. But what is interesting is sometimes the defendants don't know about a case until potentially the eve of the statute of limitations, and they're like, oh, why did I get served? What's this all about? What I've learned, and maybe you guys don't even know this, but when I get a case, and, you know, we're assessing the case. Are we going to do this case? We investigate it. We're like, you know, we're going to do this case. And you send a letter out to the defendant. And in some cases, your letter says, hey, listen, we're going to represent this person for, or this estate or whatever it is. And we're putting you on notice because we expect you to preserve all the evidence. We understand that there was video potentially. And
there
surveillance.
There wasn't, by the way, but go ahead.
Well, this was, you know, in some cases, you just know there's video there, like in a bank or something like that.
I got you.
But it's an opportunity for us to let them know that, you know, we're out there. And number two, please preserve the evidence, because if you don't preserve it, and it could be used, if it's destroyed, it could be used. There's a presumption that if it existed, it would be negative as to your part of the case. But Here's my point. I have found that in a big time case that could potentially result in some significant damages and certainly a lot of notoriety associated with the case. I'll sometimes get a response from an insurance company, which is fine, typical. But lately, as I've had a couple of very significant cases come in the door in the last 3 or 4 months, I send the letter, you know, preserve the evidence, and now I'm getting letters from lawyers. And that's never happened before.
Well, because it's changed. I think defendants, I mean, we have seen a change in the law, and courts are very interested in making sure that evidence is protected, and there's an obligation on both sides. The plaintiff as well, by the way. The obligation to preserve evidence isn't merely with the defense, it's with the plaintiffs. So there's an obligation for them to, if it is an automobile accident, preserve that car. You need to allow me to take a look at it so I can have my experts determine and look at crash analysis, and things like that. But this, there has been a change in the way that we practice law, and, mm-hmm. and that change has been driven by changes in society. We have video cameras, we have technology, we have so many things that we didn't have 10 or 15 years ago. Cell phones, right? I mean, the ability of people to take pictures at the site, to record evidence that otherwise wouldn't be recorded, surveillance cameras everywhere. These obligations have put new burdens and new requirements on all of us, on both sides of the bar, to take that evidence preservation very seriously. And when insurance companies receive, we call it an LOP, a letter of preservation. When an LOP comes out, it's a flashing red light for insurance companies. Retain counsel, get with their insured, get all the evidence you can and preserve it to the best of your ability, because you know great lawyers like John are going to come back and they're going to say, oh, you failed to preserve that evidence. You knew or should have known that that evidence was critical. And now I'm going to have a court instruct a jury why had you your failure to preserve that evidence should be taken as a negative thing because it wouldn't have been good for you. So it's really changed the way that we all practice law.
So jumping out of my seat, getting this case on the eve of the statute of limitations. How in the hell, especially in a hospitality situation, am I, you know, are we going to get evidence? Or, you know, in other words, it's 2 years ago. How can I even barely, I mean, we're going to defend the case, obviously. But the fact of the matter is, how can we expect to collect evidence aside from interviews from employees that may not even be there anymore? You know, it's a very difficult situation.
I got to respond because it's going to bring Greg into this this discussion.
Well, first of all, Greg's been dominating this, and we just appreciate it. He just chill.
He always just does that. Calm him down constantly.
You talk about the entertainment industry, and right. I'm getting these papers on the eve of. I had a case, in which is how I met Greg, where a guy that we represented who used to be one of our bankers here, and that's how we got the case, but. He was at one of the clubs in town, and he fell. And when he first fell, you know, he called our office. He was sitting at Hahnemann, and he couldn't feel his legs. And we walk in, and he truly was paralyzed from the waist down. And Jesus. I'm thinking to myself, Jesus, this case could be, you know, really something. And, you know, the guy was crying. He was hysterical. He didn't know if he's going to ever walk again. Fortunately for him, they did surgery and, you know, he got his ability to walk again. And the case changed dramatically from a damage standpoint, obviously. But what's interesting is I sent a letter to the venue.
And was it on South Street?
No. But I sent a letter to the venue and I said, you know, we're going to be representing this guy. And, you know, they didn't hear boo. You know, that was it. Nothing. Although eventually I got a letter from a carrier saying, you know, we're going to be representing we're the insurance reps. And, you know, we had to file a lawsuit for a variety of reasons. But that's an example of sending letters, not hearing boo, having to send another letter. And eventually somebody's paying attention. The insurance company steps in and, you know, at some point, you know, as a lawyer, I got to file suit. This case isn't going to settle. You always hope it's going to settle, but it's not going to settle without having to litigate it. And, of course, Greg entered his appearance on their behalf. And like everything else, the case, not like everything else, but like a lot of my cases, they come in, you think it's going to go straight ahead. And it invariably goes far right or far left. And you're like, okay, how did I get here? And you got to figure out how to get it back to the center. You know, we're in a proactive business on this side of the table. And it's very challenging. It's very challenging. And Greg here, you know, did a great job spotting all the issues. And, you know,
Jump in, Greg.
Fortunately, we were able to settle the case.
Yeah, no, it was an interesting case. And John certainly summarized it well. It could have been a real bad damages case for the client. And fortunately, he was an inspired, you know, individual that made a good recovery. There were disputes about how far that recovery went. And I think social media was a thing that played a part in that case.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
And that goes both ways, you know, regarding preserving things like that, you know. But in the end, to bring it back to your point about how in the heck are you supposed to save something 2 years later, what the court would say, and I think in John's case, for example, should you have anticipated litigation, you know?
Well, first of all, let's play that. I didn't get an accident. I looked at all my incident reports, okay? And we keep our incident reports. Video 2.5 years later, I get it. I mean, it's just a comment, but it's just when you get it that late in the game, it can be a difficult discussion.
So that's the thing. The analysis would go back. Did you create an incident report? If you did, if a good plaintiff's attorney like John would say, well, why'd you create an incident report? Well, you thought litigation was going to happen. Oh, great. So you save that, your self-serving written document written in your own words and handwriting, but then you don't save anything else. It's almost, frankly, better that if you didn't do an incident report and then you said, look, something happened. They went out. We'd never heard about it. 2 years later, bing, bang, boom. Now you're telling me there's something
well,
I couldn't have anticipated.
What I would say to you is, as my attorney, you know, we have a lot of incident reports. I mean, sure. Obviously, we're open 365 days a year.
Sure.
So we don't have one for that date.
Sure.
Which, in our opinion, means it didn't happen.
Sure.
But I can tell you this, and this is interesting. I went before an arbitration panel. Now, this is interesting on this side of the table. Girl gets in a fight at my nightclub. So it's an after-hours nightclub, and so we got busy at 3 o'clock. No, 2 o'clock. And she said that the fight was at 2:15. She was going for less than $50,000. So it was
arbitration.
Right. So she goes in. I'm sitting there. We're at the panel. We got the three lawyers right there. And the girl says she gets in a fight. I have, you know, we're expecting 1,000 people. At 1:45, at 1:30 in the morning, there's 20 in there. She says she gets in a fight at 1:40. And our security did not intervene for 15 minutes. That is an impossibility. It's literally an impossibility.
I would agree with that.
Okay, but listen to this. I wasn't begrudging the girl. She said that she lost wages because that's how she marketed her hair business. Okay, so I wasn't trying to screw her over. But I was whenever I went, even though I was only literally named in. I mean, I was named in everyone. I got dropped in everyone except one. But having said that, they settled with her. My insurance company settled with her, and I wasn't trying to bust, you know, anybody's butt. But at the end of the day, I was sitting there going, guys, you know, what are we doing here? If we can't win this, we just can't win. Can we get Malik on the phone?
There's a lot of reasons why insurance companies settle cases, and I sometimes think a case is going to get settled, and it doesn't settle. And another time, I'm thinking this is never going to settle. I get a call out of the blue, and I'm like, what?
Well, why would
and I can never explain it. And to this day, I'm doing this for 35 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, there's no rhyme or reason to this business.
Yeah, it's like.
So there's lots of reasons cases settle, and there's lots of reasons why cases don't settle. Cases settle because of an economic reason. Cases settle when you have insurance companies because they know they have to pay their lawyers X.
Right.
But there are times that an insured, the company that has purchased the insurance from the insurance company, will go back to that insurance company and say, I don't want you to settle this case because it's going to affect my rates down the line. I don't want that reputation as being someone who's going to be sued and settled. Greg, in our practice, we represent a lot of companies that are Fortune 100 companies that have very large, you may know the term deductible in your car insurance. We call it a self-insured retention. We have clients of ours that are sued constantly and want to send a message out to the plaintiff's bar that, you know, we're going to pay the cases that we are responsible for. And the reality is that there are lots of times where defendants are responsible for the injuries sustained by plaintiffs, and those plaintiffs deserve to be compensated fairly.
Sure.
And I will tell you, John's going to laugh when I say this because he is on the other side of the table. But I think John would be surprised how many times the conversation that Greg and I have with insurance companies and our clients are, we owe it. Let's pay it. Let's give her some fair.
I'm actually not surprised because it's coming from you, but that's a story for a different day.
You know, and that's what we try to bring realism to it. Listen, you know, we're at fault. Greg and I have had many cases where we walk in the courtrooms and we say, ladies and gentlemen, we admit we're responsible for the accident. The disagreement is what this plaintiff is fairly entitled to. We'll check the box for the jury.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because...
And I hate when defense lawyers do that. I hate it because part of fanning the flame of a jury is if there's really bad facts. The last thing I want is for some defense lawyer to come in and say, you know what, we'll stipulate to liability. And what that means is the jury doesn't get to hear about, well, a lot of times you can backdoor it in, but the jury doesn't get to hear about all the bad things that caused this accident or caused my client to get injured. Instead, they're just sitting. But they're sitting there listening to how badly injured someone is. And it's just a discussion amongst doctors to determine how injured is this person. And it's a whole different dynamic when you're not talking about bad behavior.
We recognize as defense lawyers that jurors are everyday people. And everyday people want people who are responsible for their conduct to step up and say, I'm responsible. Show contrition. And when that happens, your arguments about the person isn't as injured as they say, they didn't lose the amount of money that they say, it's not going to be a lifetime of pain and suffering, becomes more credible to a jury because they said, these guys stepped up and said, we're responsible. And guys like John do hate that.
No, it's interesting. No question. It's interesting because as you were talking, and I was thinking back on that case, it settled for like 20, 22, 23. Didn't settle for the whole 50. And it's possible, like you said, that there were other factors involved in that decision. It should, you know, at that point, it was deep in our career, and we were just at the end of our rope. Talk about it as a defense, and we're going to get into a number of other things, but that conversation, you know, with the insurance company, what with your client, when you have a situation where you're going to stipulate and your client, for not a good reason, is disagreeing with you.
One word you kept using is client, and it's a thing that Ted really pushes hard on the mentees such as myself, is that you represent the actual defendant. You know, there's all these discussion about client. You spend a lot of times talking to the insurance adjuster and the insurance carrier, claims examiner. But in the end, the decision really rests with you and whoever you're representing, you know, the driver, the bar, whatever we're talking about here. So the first discussion is with that individual and if that's something they feel comfortable doing, and you can explain it to them, because in the end, they have to answer the complaint and sign off on it. And then facts can change, and you could, you know, amend your answer down the line. But the first discussion is with the client. And then you have a group discussion with the carrier and explain the benefits or downfalls of abandoning a defense. But in the end, for what John and Ted both said, sometimes if it is a toss-up on the defense, the toss-up ends up typically going to, in our eyes at least, conceding negligence to take the air out of the balloon. It's like, to use a sports analogy, when you're on defense and you see the other team and you're hoping they pass the ball on third down, you know, third and two, and you see the quarterback drop back. That feels better sometimes than them running the ball because you know you got a better chance to defend it. You want to do the play that the other team doesn't want to see.
Let me just add this. And I think a lot of people that aren't in our business don't understand this. They think that lawyers that are retained by insurance companies to represent the insured represent the insurance company. We represent the insured. When you get a policy of insurance, your insurance company has agreed to do two things. One, hire a lawyer for you, and pay what's called indemnity, a settlement or a verdict. And what happens is after the years, and John will appreciate this, even being on the other side, you reach a level of confidence where you say to your client, you're wrong.
You've seen this before.
You owe the case. And going in there and making this foolish argument that we're not responsible is going to burn us. So let's step up. And that's a confidence.
And do they listen to you?
Sometimes. Most of the times they do, John. Most of the times they do.
But Ted, but on the contrary, you've been doing this a long time. And, you know.
I dye my hair this color, by the way. It's all white.
Listen, I'm completely dyed.
I'm starting to do the same thing.
Same, my hair is the same color as John's.
Hold on. This guy. Right,
I'm not too far.
But interesting. On the contrary, what you know, your experience. Talk about situations where you know there was a lot on the line where you said, "Listen, we got to hold the line here," and I know that we're right. I mean, they, you know, there has to be situations.
This guy here tries to defend some of the biggest cases in the city and against some of the best plaintiffs' lawyers in the city, so he could share. And answer that question right on target.
Let's do it.
Listen, we've had some. I don't want to mention clients or other lawyers, but yeah, I mean, so you asked me what I do. So people come to me personally for what are called catastrophic cases. I'm retained by what are called excess insurance companies, which sit above the primary. And Greg and I, because we're a team, get in to represent the worst of the worst cases in the city against the best of the best, guys like John, other people in the city who specialize in catastrophic injury cases. And they're bad. And you know what? Some of these people are catastrophically injured, and when it's not their fault, they deserve to be fairly compensated. And my experience has been with my clients is they get that. The difference is what's fairly compensated. John's job is to get them as much money as possible.
Yeah, but, and maybe you appreciate this, maybe you don't. One of the problems you have as a plaintiff's lawyer is, I had this situation yesterday. I was in a deposition the entire day. And frankly, it's still not over. They got to bring my client back for
the same day yesterday, man.
For more hours. But and I didn't get upset with the defense lawyers because I understand the medical history is extremely complicated. There's a brain injury here, and you know sometimes when a guy's wasting my time, I'm sitting there saying, "Come on, all right, let's be done. Are we done? You know, how much longer are you going to be?" It was 6 o'clock, and I said, "You know, let's take a break." We went, got defense lawyer, put him in my office. I said, "You're not close to being done yet, are you?" He goes, "No." I go, "How much more time you need?" He goes, 3-4 hours. Now, normally I'd say, "What?" I get it. And I was like, "We got to wrap this up. Let's reconvene." And normally I hate doing that, but I agreed to do that. But the point I'm making is my job, and I told my client this yesterday, as I brought him back in and he's upset. And I'm giving it to him. And I'm kind of saying, you know, what? Why did you? You know, we went through this. Why did you testify like that? He threw something out in its testimony yesterday I never heard before. And I'm sort of going, what? But I said to him, I said, it's not my job to tell you what's good about your case. It's my job to tell you what's bad about your case. Because I spend sometimes 1 or 2 years bringing that client down from the mountain. Because a lot of them have totally unreasonable expectations of what their case is worth. And I have told people.
You mean compared to the McDonald's coffee?
That ship, thankfully, has now set sail. I haven't had to explain that one anymore.
Right.
But I spend a lot of my time bringing these people down to earth. And if you don't hit them head square in the face
right. And
make sure that they have reasonable expectations – when it comes time to settle that case, You're done. There's nobody that's going to talk them down. And I spend a lot of time talking to the other lawyers in this office saying, you got to make sure that these folks know where it's at. And not going back, but I am going to go back to the case I had with Greg. The gentleman that I represented, he kind of had pie in the sky expectations for quite a long time. And Greg mentioned social media. Yeah. And we have to talk about that.
Oh yeah.
Because when I meet a client out of from day one, go through the fee agreement, explain what that means and who's going to be responsible for what and what we're going to pay for and how we get paid and all that good stuff.
It's a contingency fee, right?
Yeah. But there's more to it. You got to read it, explain it to them, tell them what the costs are. We advance the cost. They have to understand how that works. And in this day and age, that's now you're financing stuff and it's a whole, you got to explain it all. But I now have a paragraph. I give them an introductory letter on how to be a good client. And on the second page of that letter is a whole paragraph about social media and about posting stuff. And, you know, why in God's name, first of all, I'm a very private person in my life.
Move it to the first page.
but why you want to advertise what's going on in your life and this social media crave in this country, which has really infected a lot of people from 40 years and younger, and the 30 years and younger are really...
I've heard lawyers...
It's so bad, but they can't help themselves.
Sure.
I said, please, please don't post things on social media. Don't say, hey, I just met this lawyer. We're going to sock it to these people. We're going to do this. I've seen all kinds of stuff. Now, I don't search the media like these guys do. But what helped settle that case? I'm convinced of it. I'm not sure my client will ever admit to it. But Greg found some things that you could argue were compromised my client's position. Not terribly. Like, not even sitting there, like, caught him in a flat-out lie.
He wasn't bench pressing 450 pounds.
Well, but the point, what it was is he was proud of himself in his rehabilitation. So he'd post things of himself in the gym. And, you know, he was involved in some social things where he wanted it posted. And it wasn't the most flattering look, for lack of a better word. But it really... It helped me get the case resolved because what do you want me to do with this?
Well, it's interesting. I've had attorneys. We've done the shows where an attorney, and John, you mentioned a number of things, you know, as a plaintiff's attorney, I find amazing about the law, and when you're talking about legal representation, okay, whether it's defense or obviously plaintiff, but particularly plaintiff, is the contingency fee agreement. And the fact that you're vetting cases, you're investing in them, you're putting out, years before you either get a settlement or a verdict or you don't. I remember the one show we did where the attorney spent, that was like 2-3 years on this case. There was, a lot of, obviously, I don't know if we call it investment or whatever, and there it was on social media.
I don't put it this way. I don't have to go to Vegas. I gamble for a living.
That's right. But my point is that social media, that was the end of the case.
But okay? it's devastating.
But it might not, and I don't say it is devastating. It may not paint the whole picture.
It's better than surveillance. I mean,
it is surveillance.
Because, well, but it's the
But you're not even allowed to take it down, right?
It's the clients. The clients that are handing it over, surveillance. I love when they do surveillance because then you get the whole, you get everything. How many hours they were there, and you see you're only watching 15 minutes. Wait a minute, you were there for 36 hours. Where's the rest of the tape? And of course, there's obvious reasons why we haven't seen the rest of the tape. And you bury these guys, and the jury doesn't like anybody being intrusive on anybody's life. And you can have a lot of fun with the guy with the camera. All right, okay. You're better off with these clients posting stuff about themselves. It's just brutal.
I want to say a couple of things, and particularly to lay people that listen to this show. You know, I've had over the years lay people say, and we've done some plaintiff's cases over the day, wow, you're taking a third or 40% of my money. And, and I have the greatest respect for my colleagues that do plaintiff side, because my response is, well, when you pay your doctor, does he guarantee you that you're going to get better? When you pay this guy, is it guaranteed to get better? Because plaintiff lawyers lay it on the line. They lay their own money on the line. They lay their time on the line, and they are vested in the case. And if they don't win, they walk home with nothing.
Amazing.
Your life is the same. So much harder in a lot of respects to do what John does, because he's got to take a financial risk. And if he takes your case, he believes in your case because he's got skin in the game.
On any given day, this law firm has over 7 figures out on the street on any given day in cases.
Yeah, and having said that, I feel I did a show with a plaintiff's attorney who was running for judge, and we couldn't put it on the radio because it was a week before. But I did a favor; we were going to just produce a podcast and let him put it up on his website.
Did he win?
He did not win, but he was running. but he was running for family court. Okay, and the guy's kind of far out there, but he was running for a good reason. Okay, he adopted some kids and had a bad experience with a judge, and so we talked about it, and he said to me, I don't know if I'm proud of what I do, and I said, well, let's think about it for a second. You make it possible for somebody who could never afford a legal representation, and you don't ask for any out-of-pocket costs, and you take it, at the risk with somebody who is in bad shape. I don't think that's anything to be.
I can respond to that, and I don't know who this gentleman lawyer.
You probably woman. Do, but
well,
yeah, I won't mention.
There's degrees of plaintiffs' lawyers in this city, and you choose the level of risk you're going to take. And going back in my career, you start out with reasonably easier cases. You start out with cases that really don't have a factual dispute or liability dispute. Generally car accident style type cases where you're dealing only with an insurance company. And as you mature as a lawyer, you take on bigger, harder cases where at the end of the day, your head's going to explode because you can't take it anymore. I know more medicine right now than I ever dreamed to know. All right. I am now learning physics and learning and understanding, G forces, F forces, whatever alphabet of soup force there is to understand when a crash dummy hits and there's a late airbag deployment. When the case is done, I want to forget it because I can't take it anymore. There's so much in my head. But the point I'm making is you can be proud as a lawyer taking on those cases because the risk is enormous. The clients are generally catastrophically injured and you're helping them change their lives. I don't know how much, just going back on my career, when I look back on the cases I did, and listen, people have to be represented regardless of how injured they are. But the reward in what I do is when you help change someone's life because they've been destroyed from some event. That is enormously rewarding. So I can't speak for that person, but if he's doing cases like that, I'd be surprised that he wouldn't feel good about what he's doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a perspective he hadn't thought about. Ted, let me ask you a question. You talk about, we have I get the privilege to meet some and do some broadcasts with some really great attorneys and outstanding people, and today's no exception. So having said that, when you've obviously walked into the courtroom and looked on the other side and seen a lot of different attorneys. Now, your admiration for John and vice versa, and of course Greg, is one thing. And you walk into, I'm sure you meet a lot of individuals that are really worthy. Have you ever walked into a case that you felt strong about, but also looked across the table and said, this individual's, obviously not in the category who shouldn't be in here. Or
I'm glad you didn't ask me that question. I'm glad that's on.
I asked that question because also being able to endear themselves. I just met you guys 30 minutes ago, and I already know that in front of a jury, and I know this about John. You can touch that jury. okay? But we've all seen people that are prickly, okay? Have you ever walked into, has that ever factored into a decision on whether, you know, to go forward with a case? Not just that factor. You may feel strong about the case, but it might be normally one you choose not to
fight.
The
question is, how much does the lawyer's confidence on the other side make a difference?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question, and I really want to answer the question in the way that John framed it. When you have a case that's brought by a guy like John, and there's other lawyers in the city of equal caliber, maybe not in John's mind.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Ted, that's disputed. But
yeah,
let's move
right.
Forward.
No, but my point is, as defense lawyers, we certainly look at the caliber of our opponent in making decisions as to the resolution and the value of the case. Because I'll give you an example. John is a guy that if he takes a case and he doesn't get the right offer,
He's going to court.
There are plenty of lawyers in this town that are litigators. They're not trial lawyers. I try a lot of cases. I know the people that try those cases. And when I report back to my clients, whether they're the companies themselves that have large deductibles or the insurance companies, I'll say, he's a hold 'em and fold 'em. He'll take our number. He's never picking a jury. Or he's a crazy SOB. He will try this case to verdict and then you're going to let a jury decide. So reputation, experience, and results are very important in factoring in our decisions on valuation and whether we're going to take that case to trial.
Well, it's interesting because I've heard those points of view, John, on the plaintiff's side, having the resources to be able to go the distance. And the really kind of crazy thing is a client doesn't know any better. They don't know that they're at a boutique firm, and this particular individual, and there's nothing with some great boutique firms, but they don't have the resources. They're making their decision on whether to settle based on the rent that they're paying.
But I think the most significant thing that Ted just said was, you're going to let a jury decide. That's not so bad if you're a defense lawyer and practicing in the middle of the state.
I was just going to say that, right?
All right. I'll take that bet any day of the week if I'm a defense lawyer. All right. So as a plaintiff's lawyer, I have to assess, where's my venue? Where am I trying this case? Because letting a jury decide is a huge question that I have to answer. Because if I'm in, I don't know, any one of those counties in between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, I'm thinking long and hard. I could have an accidental decapitation and say to myself, I don't think I still want a jury to decide, because they might have thought it was God's will that your client lost his head. Because I've actually taken, you're smiling.
No,
true story.
True story.
I'm doing voir dire in Lancaster County, and that's, you know, selecting a jury. And I challenged the judge. And I said, Judge, please let us take individual voir dire. He's acting like he doesn't have enough time. I said, Judge, I'm from Philly. We got a trial list that's, you know, people waiting years and years, and they allow us to do individual voir dire. You know, show of hands, and whoever's saying yes to whatever, we can bring them back. We'll get it done in a day. And I did say something stupid. Then I said, maybe you'll learn something. And he didn't like that, which was, I couldn't help myself. But I learned something. We take these people back. It was a malpractice case, which is usually the kiss of death in a place like Lancaster. I actually had somebody, I said, well, you answered, you couldn't, I don't even remember what the question was. But she looked at me straight in the face, and she goes, well, Mr. Zvonis, you know, sometimes it's God's will that something like this happens. And I just sat in my seat, and I'm thinking to myself, how do I get a fair jury in this county when people are putting God into the equation as to why we're even here?
Right.
And it scared me so much.
You settled immediately?
I ultimately settled the case. I don't know if it was immediately or shortly thereafter, but I told my client, you can't afford, there was enough money on the case that we couldn't, if it's zero, you're trying your case. But I said, you can't afford. What I heard in that back room was so scary that, and I think in a Philadelphia trial, and I'll admit this, you know, as a plaintiff's lawyer, I want to be in Philly because the juries are a lot more generous and much more willing to buy the plaintiff's side of the case than the defendants. At least historically, that's usually the way it pans out in this county.
Yeah, talk about that, if you will, Ted. And by the same token, is it important for you, obviously, to come across as a defense attorney to make a connection with the jury?
So when we decide, when a case is filed, and as John told you, a lot of people want to file in Philadelphia, and they want to file in Philadelphia because Philadelphia is a cosmopolitan city. People are earning more money. People are open to greater ideas. And historically, it's been classified as a liberal jurisdiction. As a matter of fact, it was rated the number one toward hellhole by the Chamber of Commerce 2 years ago. So as defense lawyers, we are, in fact, looking to get cases out of Philadelphia. And oftentimes they don't belong in Philly. I just tried a case to verdict 6 weeks ago. The case happened in upstate Pennsylvania near the New York border. It so happened that my client does business in the city of Philadelphia, and the plaintiff was able to bring suit in it. And by the way, this was a case where significant injury. And this guy couldn't help but post constantly about his life. We had pictures of him on Instagram and Snapchat and TikTok riding a motorcycle and doing things that and as John said, well pointed, because that was my line to the jury, was, you know, ladies and gentlemen, this wasn't my client taking these photographs. This was the alleged injured person who told you in this courtroom that he couldn't live his life as he did before, yet we showed you these pictures, his pictures. So yes, venue selection is very, very important. And of course, connection with a jury. And the connection is very simple. Does the jury believe you? Do they think you're credible? Or do they think you're selling them a bunch of hooey? Which is why you're pointing Greg. Why Greg is such a successful lawyer.
Well, I was going to say, Greg.
He's such a success, such a credible guy.
And having a boss like Ted and disposition and demeanor has to be impactful to you.
For sure.
Because somebody who's had that much success and is able to make that connection.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my whole shtick is just taken from others. So you are credible, but you're also taking other people's methods, because it is all just ends up being almost like a popularity contest in the end. You know, you're somebody's agent. You're speaking on their behalf, and you want that jury to like you. And it really does come down to credibility. And Ted does it. And all the good trial attorneys do it. You make promises in the beginning of your case, and you got to meet your promise. And then in the end, Ted, when he gives his close, will give the jury almost their marching orders to go back. And if they say this, well, then you can answer that. And, you know, and gives them the things to say. And if they follow the things that he says, it's because they believe him, because they believe he's credible. And it truly does come down to looking them in the face and being able to, you know, fully back what you say.
We only have a few minutes left, okay? And I want to cover a couple things. First of all, we talked a little bit about sports at the beginning of the show and all that, and you mentioned giving that closing remarks. What's that like? Because you have so much on the line. This didn't start 2 weeks ago. You got somebody's life. And I always equate, and we've done shows on sports and law, And the fact that, you know, as an athlete, you know, no matter what you played, you know, even if it wasn't organized, you're performing and you're at the, and I would always say, because I've coached some high school sports, that look, you can either, and it's the same in anything, you can either get out there and worry about failing or worry about making a mistake, and you will, or you can get out there and, you know, just kind of show them what you got.
You talking about the closing argument?
Yeah. What's that like? You have someone's life on the line. You have 20 million dollars of your clients, assets on the line. What is that like when you're in that position? Game time, right?
I don't think most people, other than people that try cases for a living, understand the pressure of closing arguments. First of all, you're exhausted. If your trial has lasted 3 or 4 weeks, you're working 18, 19 hours
you
a day,
are shot.
You're barely
no
sleeping, and time, sleep, and food
are your biggest resources that you can't get enough of. You can't get enough sleep. You can't get enough food. You're working.
The sleep deprivation is insane.
Yeah, and that's why law school is so difficult, because they try to get you ready for that. So, you know, closing arguments, you hope that you can build every day. I know we have a formula that we use in our office that we build into it. And here's where it's a little bit different than the metaphor that you gave. You can't, and I think most trial lawyers that I know at some point in their life have been competitive athletes. You have to be in this business. You gotta love winning and hate losing, and it's the competitive streak that makes you that drives you. And unlike the sports analogy where you can just go out there and throw it out there, man, if you throw it out there in closing arguments and you say something that you didn't deliver in the courtroom, or you make an accusation that you're going to get called on, John Zervanos is going to shove it so far where the sun don't shine.
That's a great way to put it.
So you have to be passionate, you have to be skilled, and you need to be accurate. Because if you're not, you are going to get hurt. And that's the big mistake when passion overtakes facts.
You know, and I know we're running out of time, but I always have this conflict. Do I stay kind of passion but stick to the narrative? Or do I grab something that the defense did in their closing or during the course of the case and get slapstick? Just something that grabs the jury's attention. And that is one of those chances that you take, because you either hit it out of the park, or you're taking your tail, pulling it between your legs, walking away and knowing you just laid an egg and you may have just lost your case because you decided to be smart.
And when you get to court, at that point, it's usually a couple years of hard work in that process.
I can tell you one thing, and I'll make it quick. I tried a case years ago in Reading, Pennsylvania. It was a malpractice case. And we heard about Alex Jones's Perry Mason moment. I thought I had a Perry Mason moment in this trial. It was an extraordinary moment where the judge, I cornered the defense doctor, and I said to him, "Well, didn't you tell me that in your deposition?" And he said, "That was foolish." And I kind of stopped in my tracks and did the whole pause thing for emphasis. And then I turned around and I said, "What did you just say?" I couldn't remember. "Court reporter, can you please read back to the jury what he just said?" I knew what he said. Question, answer, foolish. I said, "Foolish? You were under oath, weren't you?" "Yes." "Could you look at those 12 people in that box and explain to them why it was foolish to tell me the truth on whatever date the deposition was?" And I'm walking around proud as a peacock thinking, "Holy mackerel, I fell into this one.
Holy grail, right?"
Yeah. And I have an associate in the back looking at me going, "Oh, man, this is good." You take your bathroom break. The hospital wants to settle with you. You take their money. The doctor's still sitting out there. Close of the jury. Reminded them about that moment in the case. I remember, I'll never forget it. It was a Friday night, the Friday before Thanksgiving. I'm up there. The sun goes down quick in late November. I'm in Reading, which is in a great place to be walking around. Jury's out. It's Friday night. I'm like, "Okay, come on. What's taking so long?" You know, I'm thinking I'm posting this verdict in the legal on Monday. They deed me. I was like, "What?" You know, I was stunned. Even the judge was stunned. Because the hospital paid money after that moment. And I grabbed a couple of the jurors because I was like, I'm going after them. I got to find out what happened. And one woman said to me, "You know how you cross-examined that doctor? And I could tell you were so proud of yourself." This is an older lady. And I'm looking at her. And she says, "You humiliated him." Now, this was about 10, 15 years ago. It was such a lesson. It was such an unbelievable lesson that I learned at that moment that I have never, ever forgotten it.
Showboating.
I will never showboat again. I'm going to try not to, put it that way, because we all have egos and we can't help ourselves.
Right.
But it was an extraordinary lesson. It was one of the worst drive homes I've ever had. And I just thought about that statement over and over and over again, and I've never forgotten.
Guys, I can tell you
something. By the way, every trial lawyer worth his salt has had that experience. I've had the exact experience where I destroyed a plaintiff on cross-examination, peacock around the courtroom, come back in, verdict got slammed. In one particular case, in particular, I'll never forget a judge, John Herron. I was a young lawyer. And I saw Judge Herron 2 months, 3 months later walking in the hallway, and I see him, and I said, I still haven't gotten over. I lost that case. He said, you know, kid, you embarrassed yourself, and you made the jury feel bad for that witness.
Yeah.
You made them feel bad, and that comes with experience. That comes with you know, years at the bar and being in court and knowing when to put it out there and when not. But it's
a balance, man. It's such a balance.
You know, guys, let me just say this. We got about a minute left, but I got to ask you this. Anybody like baseball here?
I try to.
There we go. This week I do. Well, this season, right. So far I do.
We'll talk after the weekend, right? The Mets are playing the Mets. I say that because it's a game of failure, right? And I wonder sometimes. And I love baseball, but as I get older, I don't like to lose. Well, if you're a great team, you're going to lose 62 times a year minimum, okay?
If you're a good hitter, you strike out seven
times.
That's
right, okay? You look at some of Tony Gwynn's stats, you know, you won't even believe it. But the point is, how do you bounce back? How do you recover? You know, nobody bats 1,000. We only got 30 seconds each on this. How do you? And I know you just win. You guys have had great success.
You got to win enough because you wouldn't be in business.
Obviously, I know that. But how did you pick yourself up from that, John?
You got to take it as a learning. You got to learn from it, and you know that you're going to get hit in the mouth again, and you're going to get hit in the mouth again. If you don't learn from it, you got to get out of the business.
I can't say it any better than that.
Greg?
Yep, that's about it, man. You just got to, this is Philadelphia especially. You know, you got a lot of tough people here, and you just got to be a little bit tougher than everybody else.
This is not a job for the faint of heart.
Absolutely. Sure. Well, listen, gentlemen, this has been the fastest hour in radio. John, we didn't get to the pandemic.
Pandemic?
That's fine by me.
We were
going to
talk
about the
pandemic impacted everybody's business.
That's right. I figured we wouldn't. So.
But here's the thing. It's been a great show, Ted. Awesome, man. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
Yeah, Greg,
it's a pleasure.
You got to keep your mouth shut.
Well, I'm going to try. Keep it down next time.
No, fantastic, man. And it's great to meet you guys. John Zervanos, our host. Another fantastic show. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Soul of Zervanos show on WWDB Talk 860. We really appreciate our guest Ted Scher and Greg Malm of Zarwin Bar, and of course on behalf of our host John Zervanos and Ted and Greg, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Soloff and Zervanos has your back. If you or someone you know is the victim of physical or sexual abuse or assault by an individual or individuals as a result of the negligence or fault of an organization who may have allowed it to occur, please understand that you are not alone and justice could be but one comforting and confidential phone call away. Please contact the law firm Soloff and Zervanos at 215-608-4067 if you, a loved one, or someone you know is the victim of physical or sexual abuse or assault by an individual or individuals as the result of negligence of an organization, and let their comforting, discreet, and understanding attorneys seek the justice you deserve. Again, contact the law firm Soloff and Zervanos at 215-608-4067 and let them seek the justice you deserve. Soloff and Zervanos, they have your back.